Hey, hey, happy new year. This is Cedric Youngelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Today's episode with Alex Svetsky, covering his latest piece from the Bitcoin Times Energy Edition, Uber Money, Nietzsche's Missing Ingredient, is brought to you by River. Friends and family always ask me, Ced, where should I buy Bitcoin? And I always send them to River. River is the Bitcoin exchange of choice for the long-term investor. I've been using River for over 3 years because they are a Bitcoin-only company that has earned my trust through their proof of work. Securely buy Bitcoin at the tightest spreads in the industry. Have peace of mind thanks to their 100% full reserve cold storage custody, and enjoy zero fees on recurring orders. River built and owns their own infrastructure. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. And I suggest that if you haven't done so already, that you learn how to do so immediately. If you need help getting started or have questions, River has US-based phone support for all their clients. River just launched a new product called RiverLink, allowing you to send Bitcoin over a text message that you can claim to any wallet. Give a gift, pay a friend for dinner, or orange pill your friends in the easiest way possible. As the economy is transformed by Bitcoin, River's products and services will be at the forefront of that evolution. Use my referral link in the show notes to get started and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin. Your Bitcoin deserves the best protection. With Thea, you're in charge. No more fears of losing your keys or falling prey to hackers. Their self-custody multi-sig vaults empowers you to be the ultimate guardian of your Bitcoin. This is revolutionary technology, and Thea makes it so user-friendly and smooth. It's also intuitive, comfortable, and most importantly, secure. But I really like what Thea is doing to make Bitcoin multi-sig just so damn easy, especially for my family and loved ones. Thea enables shared custody, making a family-friendly choice for safeguarding your digital legacy. And for those unexpected moments, Thea's got your back. Their multi-device vaults with both assisted and sovereign recovery options mean your Bitcoin is safe, always accessible, and ready for the future. Thea is more than an app. It's your partner in the Bitcoin journey with 24/7 support from a team that cares. Download Thea now using the link in the show notes and get your first 6 months free and experience the new standard in Bitcoin multi-sig security. At the Bitcoin Advisor, I am here to help you get your Bitcoin off your exchanges. Simplify the process, address your Bitcoin challenges, and ensure you feel comfortable every step of the way. I can help you set up your multi-sig and secure your Bitcoin for decades to come while ensuring you can sleep at night with the right estate planning and asset protection strategies to make sure your Bitcoin is safe for you and your family. If you or someone you know needs help buying Bitcoin and creating a multi-sig vault, I am here to help. Head over to thebitcoinadvisor.com/Cedric now and put some time on my calendar. The link to set up time to chat with me can also be found in the show notes. I'm more than happy to chat, explain what we do, and how we can help you secure your Bitcoin for generations. Wow. Alpa Energy Bars, a new kind of energy bar. Live life untamed. Question everything. Alpa Bars are made with high-quality Colorado grass-fed beef, American-sourced fruits and nuts, and nutrient-rich beef tallow, so they make for a great pick-me-up. When I need a meal replacement, snack, or just some much-needed fuel for the burn, and I don't want toxic fiat sludge, I reach for an Alpa Premium Meat Bar, the Chad of energy bars, challenging the norm and supporting freedom. If you don't believe everything you're told, if you break the rules, strive for freedom, reach for your peak, and don't follow the mainstream, then you're one of us. On the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, we question everything, including what real health is. Go to eatalpa.com, E-A-T-A-U-P-A, now and use the code MATRIX for a discount. Link can also be found in the show notes. Hodler's Official is the Team Bitcoin merch and memorabilia company for Bitcoin's biggest fans. It's a great gift idea for yourself or your friends and family that love Bitcoin. They also do customs specifically for Bitcoin companies. Go to hodlersofficial.com today and get your Team Bitcoin gear. Use the code MATRIX for 10% off your entire purchase. The Bitcoin Matrix is proud to partner with Circle 6 Ranch, the Florida Beef Initiative, and Bitcoin Bay to offer you a taste of Black Angus beef that's grass-fed, antibiotic-free, and steeped in tradition. The Florida Beef Initiative made it clear to my family how much we need and value food, nutrition, and health security. And now we can get all of that through Circle Six Ranch, Bitcoin Bay, and the Florida Beef Initiative. Discover their premium beef selections like the Florida Pasture Beef Box and join a movement that's restoring Florida's local economy, one steak at a time. The Florida Beef Initiative and the Bitcoin Matrix Podcast. Energy secured with exceptional flavor in every succulent bite. Link for a discount can be found in the show notes. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Alex Fetsky for this awesome rip on the authenticity of authority, beauty, chutzpah, excellence, and the gravitas of Bitcoin.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Alex Fetsky, author and entrepreneur, is building non-cringe AI things at Spirit of Satoshi. Alex is the founder of the world's first Bitcoin savings platform, Amber App, and the Bitcoin Times, which are timeless, limited edition Bitcoin masterpieces by the best minds in the world, with only 2,100 of each edition ever printed. Alex also co-wrote the best-selling book, The Un-Communist Manifesto, with Mark Moss. He is now in the process of writing Bushido of Bitcoin. Alex Fetsky, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix Podcast for the fifth time. How are you, my friend?
Fifth? Jeez, I didn't know we've done five already. Holy moly.
Yeah, man. So five times. We've gone into some great shows here. And so this is your third time solo. Episode 12. I was really honored you came on so early in the run. We talked about the end of globalism. We covered about five of your pieces there. I mean, and you are prolific. In episode 69, you came on with Jessica Vaughn for Bitcoin, right? Truth, Freedom, Chutzpah, and Letting the Dead Leaves Fall. Very interesting conversation, very charged. I think you guys were in El Salvador. We just kind of talked about the state of the world and where people were coming from and where things were going. I recommend people go back to both those. 117, you came on with Mark Moss to discuss the Un-Communist Manifesto. That's right. And in 136, we discussed one of your awesome pieces, Fire, Bitcoin Teleportation, A New Timeline Before Bitcoin, After Bitcoin, which I think is a good run-up to where we're going tonight. Before we get into that, how is your knee? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm good, man. I was doing some jujitsu 2 months ago, and we were just rolling on the mats, and I don't even know how I did it. I just pulled my leg out of a hold or something like that and twisted the knee, and man, it was like killing me on the night. The next morning, I couldn't walk. Took a couple days for the swelling to settle down, and then when you just like write things off in your head, you're like, oh yeah, whatever, it'll just get better. And usually in the past, those injuries would have like healed up on their own, but this is like one of these weird things where it hasn't healed up. Like, to this day, I'm waking up in the morning, this is 2 months later, and my knee is more sore than it was the day before, which is really, it's concerning. So anyway, I'm getting my first MRI in my whole life, and let's see if it actually works.
I don't like that process, but how important is the jiu-jitsu to you, or just that sort of competition or an athletic, rigor?
I mean, I've really come to believe that mind over matter and this kind of disentanglement of the mind from the body has been a psyop. And if not a psyop, then at the very least a naive, view of the world, or a naive understanding of the world. I think it's fundamentally important. Like, the mind and the body are linked. You cannot have one without the other. One influences the other directly. Doing something that puts you in a position where you could either inflict or experience damage does something to you mentally and physically, and that sort of relationship, someone like Nietzsche calls it physiopsychology, right? Like, it's all entwined, basically. And I think, when I was young, I was very into martial arts and things like that. I did capoeira, which, mind you, is is probably the least useful of all martial arts on the planet. Like, if you want to get your ass kicked, go do capoeira. Start bouncing around someone, knock you out very, very quickly. But it's very, very useful if you do like a real martial art, like jiu-jitsu or boxing or kickboxing, something, and then you do capoeira as well. The entanglement or the mixture of those two, like capoeira, will just give you this incredible agility and this incredible ability to move around when you're doing these other martial arts. But anyway, we're kind of going off the tangents here. So I think it's extremely important. You need to know how to use your body. You need to know how to not only defend yourself but have the capacity to attack, and know how to inflict damage if it's needed. And yeah, I think it's extremely incumbent on a man to practice these things.
Well, I think this tangent will come back into play. So I'm glad we went where we did. What inspired the energy edition? You're putting together these awesome pieces of work, and with each one, you have sort of the opportunity to put a grander vision to the whole piece with the title or the approach or, how you lay it out. So what inspired this, the sixth edition?
Yeah, so I mean, as you know, there's going to be 21 editions in total of the Bitcoin Times. So, 21 editions over what's likely going to be 21 years. I don't know, maybe some years we'll do two. We'll see how sort of the timing and everything is. But of course, last year was the Austrian. And this year I was thinking, okay, what's an important theme? What's something that is like current, important, present, pertinent, all of these sorts of things. And the energy piece came to mind, obviously. And I said, all right, let's do this. It's the right time for it. So I rounded up a bunch of the key people that I think have something important to say. So Drew Armstrong, Marty Bent, Brian Gitt, Gideon Powell, Parker Lewis, Andrew Myers. And yeah, we put together what I believe is, I mean, I say this every year. This is the best edition yet. So it's. I don't want to discredit the prior editions, but like at least visually speaking, this one is gorgeous. And it, for me personally, I mean, I used to think Fire Bitcoin Teleportation was the best thing I ever wrote, but I feel like, I've upped my game in what I wrote for my piece here with Nietzsche and sort of the Uber money angle. And I really think there's just some. Like Drew's piece on entropy was fantastic. Like it just really, it's one of those things that you read. And I haven't read something like that for a while, really since I read like Gigi's early stuff, Proof of Life and his work on entropy and stuff like that. Like kind of like a cosmic sit down and you read something that just makes you think about the grander things. I haven't read something like that for a little while, and that was sort of Drew's piece. Gideon's piece was fantastic. Like, you go in there, you read it, and it just fires you up and makes you realize that, as much as everyone's got sort of their political ideologies and we should do this, we should do that, at the end of the day, like human ingenuity just drives human progress. And, you unleash that, sure, there'll be mistakes, sure, we'll fuck things up, et cetera, but man, like there's just something about creating a framework for human beings to go out there and economically compete and cooperate that transforms the very foundation of civilization. And that just can't be ignored. So anyway, it was a fantastic experience. It took us a good 8 months to put it together, and I'm still waiting on the final bits of the design, but like it's a beautiful addition. So I'm really glad I did it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fantastic piece. And, it's tough to say which would be your best piece. I mean, they all build on each other and they speak to each other. This piece, as most of the others, it challenges the reader and challenges your perspective. And I think you kind of, really hit the point really well here. So, maybe it is your best piece. Well, let's get into it. It's called Uber Money, Nietzsche's missing ingredient. So what maybe inspired this piece?
So I think it's almost an extension. Do you remember my remnant pieces from a couple of years back? Yeah, so it's almost an extension of that series, right? Like it's got the same type of energy, it's got the same type of like, to use your word from episode 69, the same kind of chutzpah, right? It's fiery, and it, as you said, it kind of like challenges people's maybe unexplored preconceptions. And really, for me, I think it was I started going down the Nietzsche rabbit hole towards the beginning of this year as I was writing the Bushido of Bitcoin. Like I'd come, I really went down the rabbit hole on like ancient cultures, ancient civilizations, what made them great, what enabled, the West to really establish itself as the bastion of civilization. Like why, what, and why was Japan so unique in Asia in particular? And that, there was these like real interesting themes there. And along the way, I read a book called War Speak, which is by a lady called Lise Van Boxel, and she basically analyzes Nietzsche's works and frames it as, he was a man who used language to go to war and to charge people, and to, to sort of like get them energetically in a place of ascendancy and of vigor and vitality. And that was sort of what Nietzsche was all about. And this really just like it struck me. My remnant pieces have always been something that, I called upon the best of people, and I said, those who don't want to, bring themselves up and, like hold that standard, fuck them, they don't matter, right? Like, and that sort of rubbed some people the wrong way. But what I found was, Nietzsche was doing this 150 years ago. Like he was the ultimate troll. Like if he was alive today and on Twitter, like he'd be the kind of guy like just basically subtweeting people going, dork, like loser, like ad hominem attacks and stuff like that. He was that kind of guy. Like, he came out at the peak of European civilization, where Europe thought they could do no wrong, that they were the, greatest thing since, since God, basically. And he kind of just said, look, all you philosophers, all you people are losers, basically. Like, this is what's really happening. There's a cancer that's infected the West. And over the next century, we're going to see the West devolve into the ugliest, lowliest, most pathetic form of itself. And people are like, okay, this guy's a fucking lunatic, he's crazy, whatever, just ignore him. And basically everything that Nietzsche spoke about has practically come true. So anyway, I wanted to sort of take that energy, take that viewpoint, take those ideas and transmute them into a Bitcoin context. And yeah, I think what's been produced in this piece is very, very interesting.
Yeah, let's dive further in. And you know, it didn't. I don't think you're in this piece. I really felt like you were trying not to troll, and you even pointed out maybe to me when you were trying to say, hey, just you know, maybe think about what I'm saying here. I'm not trying to just get a rise out of you, or however you know maybe the common parlance of troll would mean. I didn't feel that way. So I want to read a quote from Nietzsche that you put in the piece. For believe me, the secret for harvesting from existence the greatest fruitfulness and the greatest enjoyment is to live dangerously. Build your cities on the slopes of Vesuvius. Send your ships into uncharted seas. Live at war with your peers and yourselves. Be robbers and conquerors as long as you cannot be rulers and possessors, you seekers of knowledge. Soon in the age will be past when you could be content to live hidden in forests like shy deer. At long last, the search for knowledge will reach out for its due. It will want to rule and possess, and you with it. Friedrich Nietzsche, The Gay Science. What does this quote mean to you?
I mean, to me, it talks to this spirit that we've forgotten about, this spirit that we've forgotten in man, right? Like in the conqueror, in the kind of archetype. I mean, just imagine what it would have taken to get on a boat from Spain or from Portugal or from England, and to go across like uncharted seas to like find these new lands, like on a plank of wood, like in these incredible oceans, the like waves, like stuff that you can't even imagine, like rain and whales and like sharks and scurvy, and like being stuck on a boat with a bunch of other men, and like just the kind of character and the kind of human being that that needed to exist to do that, like all the Alexander the Greats of the world, like on foot for 12 or 13 years, whatever, whatever that period was from when he left Macedonia and died in where did he end up dying? I think it was in Babylon. Over mountains, snow, deserts, rivers, like they climbed the Hindu Kush with no, like, there wasn't any cable cars. Like, they were just wearing armor and skins. Like, this kind of attitude, just, I mean, in many ways, like, maybe it's embodied partly, to some degree in the Elon Musks and the Steve Jobs of the world, but it's like a sliver of that explorer, that conqueror energy, right? And I think for me, that was what Nietzsche was talking about. He was like talking about, like, hey, we are losing this energy. We are losing this drive. We're losing this vitality because we are basically domesticating ourselves. And he talks about this age will once again come. So, like, go out there and conquer again, find that energy within oneself, go out and sail in uncharted seas, right? Like, this is what it takes to build culture and therefore build civilization. And yeah, to me, that just rings ever more true today, because even in his age, it was still like, European glory and American sort of frontiersmen still existed, right? Today, like, all that's basically gone, right? So, like, if he was living today, he'd be like, what the fuck is going on? Like, he would be embarrassed, right? But this is why I have so much respect for him, is he saw this 150 years before anybody else did. Like, we always talk about Ayn Rand as like seeing stuff, and and to a massive degree, like, she articulated it probably better than anybody else through her fiction, but Nietzsche called it first. Like, and that's the really interesting thing for me.
It's interesting. I think that, I think there's with the hardest working jobs in society, they're almost the least paid or well paid usually. And even if they're well paid, least respected sometimes. Just hard work, physical labor, risk taking. And we don't see ventures anymore where there's a lot of risk of no return, but extreme reward, it seems like in the world. So to what you're getting at, I mean, the last time I could think of that. We, to maybe took extreme, with the space, maybe the space shuttle program, and that's been kind of a disaster in a lot of regards.
Yeah, I mean, like, nobody's going to Antarctica anymore and like doing an expedition, right? So Ernest Shackleton, right? Like, you don't hear that anymore. Now it's like you've got to get the U.S. government to give you a pass
Right,
to
there's no Wright
enter out there.
brothers, or there's nothing exciting that the whole world is like, are they going to do it? Are they going to make it? Is it going to happen? Are we all as a society, civilization going to make the leap together if they succeed? We don't want them to fail, but if they fail, it could be really doom for them and greatness for us if they succeed. We don't really see that. So what is Nietzsche's idea of the will to power?
So this one, I think, is really, really misunderstood. Like, and particularly, like, I guess I'm about as close to a, Christian as you can get. Like, culturally, morally speaking, my background, all that sort of stuff is fundamentally Christian. And my Christian friends, they fundamentally don't understand what Nietzsche's thing was. Like, I know Jimmy Song, for example, always talks about, like, will to power is the root of all evil, and Nietzsche was one of the nihilists who he believed that everything was about power, power, power. And they kind of like parrot these things, like, oh, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's like, to me, it's like, no, that's total bullshit. Like, first of all, power is basically like proof of work. It's the capacity to channel energy. There's nothing evil about that. There's nothing corrupting about that. It is a fact of life. And in fact, that which can channel greater energy is actually more life-affirming. Therefore, that which can channel more power, that which has more power, is more life-affirming. And this is one thing that drives me crazy sometimes about Bitcoin, is that they'll just parrot these tropes, right? Like, they'll say proof of work, proof of work, proof of work in one sentence is very good. Then they'll say power is evil. It's like, do you not realize that proof of work and power are like related? Like, they're both energy and time. Like, they're both in the same family. Like, you can't go and say that and then on the flip side say it's evil. Like, so it doesn't work like that. So, I really pushed it in this essay. I said, look, it's not that power corrupts. It's that power corrupts the weak. Like, that's a very, 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 very important distinction. Like, there's a quote from Plato, and I'm gonna butcher it, like, or paraphrase it here, but he basically says the measure of a man is what he does when he attains power or something like that, right? So it's not that power is bad. Like, so, you know, this is, I mean, I wanted to sort of like pick that bone, and we'll pick this up later anyway, because I think it's an important topic. But to come back to will to power before I get carried away here, what Nietzsche was talking about in will to power is the fact that we as human beings, as living entities, we are a mixture of drives, right? We have a drive, like, why do I have a drive to eat? Like, you know, why do I have a, why is it that, you know, I have a drive to build something? What is this drive that encourages me to read a book or to have this podcast that we're having, you know, to have a conversation? Why is it that I have a drive to go out and, you know, enjoy the beach, you know, or to sleep or to get some sunshine, or to, you know, philosophize or to think or to write, or that I have a drive towards, you know, my wife or something attractive or food, whatever? Like, what the fuck are these drives? So Nietzsche says, look, we have all of these drives in us. What conducts the drives is this master sort of like will, and he calls that the will to power. Like, so it is, you know, another way you could understand this, you know, concept of a will to power is it is your life force, you know, or it is the governing force that channels life through you. You know, I don't know how else to kind of like frame this, but it is the thing that if you've got all of these drives that are, you know, oftentimes competing, the greater your will to power, the greater your capacity to align all of these drives in a particular direction to therefore make you more vital. And the more vital you are, the more power you can channel, the more energy you can channel, and therefore makes you a greater, more vital being, right? That's his whole premise, is that the will to power is the necessary component of channeling one's drives in a coherent fashion and in a particular direction. And that is fundamentally about as moral and as virtuous as one could get. It is far from immoral, as a lot of people like to think.
So yeah, definitely thinking about power as a tool, and you know, you can use power to, you know, hurt or to help. And I like how you talk about how Bitcoin and energy, what they have in common. So you say, first of all, Bitcoin is money that in many ways resembles the kind of quality that energy is. Both energy and Bitcoin are conservative, cannot be created or destroyed. They have a direction and relationship to order and entropy, and they have absolutes, zero being the asymptotic minimum for energy, and 20,999,999.977 being the asymptotic maximum supply of Bitcoin. How does Bitcoin have its own direction?
I mean, Bitcoin has a direction, so you can't reverse it. That's the whole point of the immutability, right? So it's like tick-tock, next block. And the more blocks that pass, the more difficult it is to go backwards, right? And this is the very interesting thing about where I think Bitcoin resembles real life better than anything else, right? Is that there's no rewind button. Like, if I go tomorrow and, like, I mean, God forbid, fall over and break my leg, I can't just rewind that, right? Like, time moves forward and I need to heal and all this sort of stuff, right? So if I send my Bitcoin all to the wrong address, well, there's no hotline I can call to rewind it. Like, so this very fact that they move directionally forward in one way or in one direction, means that there is like a There's fundamentally a reality to it. Maybe reality is that which just can't be rewinded, right? Like, maybe that is the real definition of reality, and that's why Bitcoin is about as real as you can get with money.
Is energy then the universal currency?
I mean, yes, because energy and time, you know, as Carlo Rovelli talks about in his he's got a great book on sort of on physics, and he's a fantastic writer. And you know, he basically talks about like our understanding of time is basically the, you know, the direction toward greater entropy. Like, so when you have an increase in entropy, when, you know, you have energy diffusing itself, like, you have time. Like, that's how we measure time. So in that sense, like, you know, really, you might be able to boil everything down to energy, and, you know, everything therefore is like, you know, you have this complete ledger, universal ledger And the ledger is just basically energy in different parts, and all that's moving is like energy moving around in different parts from less entropy to greater entropy, and it's like this one flow.
Well, that's kind of fascinating. Do you think Bitcoin has gravitas?
Yeah, so there's a specific section in the article where I talk about weight. So gravitas, weight, they're associated to energy as well, right? Mass and energy are fundamentally related, as Einstein sort of showed us. And that which has energy, that which carries a charge, carries gravitas. And I use an example of gold in the essays in particular. And I ask people, I say, look, have you ever been handed a gold coin, or a gold bar? And like, I don't know if you have, but when you hold some gold in your hand, like it feels heavy. It feels real. Like it feels like it's got some weight. And the word gravitas, like I love here, it's like something, it's like worthy, right? And when when you have that charge, like there's like a realness about it. And this is where fiat is the complete opposite. Fiat carries no charge, it carries no weight. It is inflated to the point where it is weightless. It's just produced, 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 and it carries no charge, it carries no energy, and therefore has no value. And I make the statement in there that look, gold has developed this gravitas because for 5,000 years we as human beings have been collecting this yellow fucking stone. We've been like finding it. So what's happened is, like this is a great it's not a quote but an anecdote from Nietzsche. He says that the instincts we have today are the habits that our ancestors had, right? So like, we have an instinct about gold today because genetically speaking, like we've bred this subconscious relationship to gold in us as a human species over thousands of years. So like today, I don't care who you show it to, you show a piece of gold to someone, they don't even have to know like that it's, how much it's worth. They just by the look, touch, and feel of it, they'll know that there's some value there, right? And Bitcoin after 15 years is already starting to carry a little bit of this charge. Imagine one, two, three, four, five generations out. Like the kind of charge that Bitcoin is going to carry. Like the idea that's like, wow, like you used to send Bitcoin on the main chain? Like, really? You did that, Grandpa? Like, people, it's going to be unbelievable, right? And like that's the kind of charge that Bitcoin's going to carry. It'll be like you used to have a room full of gold. Like, what the fuck? Doesn't make any sense. Like, so that's kind of like charge and gravitas, I think, is it's an interesting angle.
I think we already experience it instinctually with Bitcoin, even early on, where people are very afraid to naturally to send it. And it te technologically, even though it's sort of self-custody and a new way of thinking about holding or kind of keeping your wealth, entering an address, digits, alphanumeric into a box on an app or some sort of internet device is not a newfangled thing for humanity. Yet with Bitcoin, people are very scared. And I think it's intuitive because they think, okay, if they lose their dollars or whatever fiat they're using, whether the bank will be there to kind of fix the boo-boo, or even if it's just gone forever, there's endless dollars going to be printed. And you can kind of get your head around it's only because a lot of times people are very scared to even send $5, $10, $20 of Bitcoin. And they're not with $5, $10, $20 or even a little bit more with fiat, but because they feel it's either going to be saved by the bank or it's replaceable in some way. They're making more of it with this Bitcoin thing. I'm going to lose mine and it's gone forever and I'm the idiot. There's that charge to it. I think that charge is misinterpreted as fear when it's really the weight of the Bitcoin and the preciousness of the sats that's being misinterpreted there. What is the last man is predicted by Nietzsche?
So, I mean, the last man is Nietzsche's way of saying lemmings, or lemmings is my way of saying the last man. So I didn't know about this concept until, recently, as probably over the last couple of months I came across, Nietzsche's framing of this last man. And basically, to give people a really brief history lesson, it's the concept of the last man is something that Nietzsche spoke about 150 years ago, as I mentioned earlier, he said, look, the cancer that is starting to seep into the West is one of democracy, equalitarianism, and average. And he said, this cancer will lead us to a culture, to a civilization that is made up of the last man. And the last man is the archetype of the cynic, the average. The one who hates greatness, the one who hates beauty, the one who wants to bring everything down to their level, the one who doesn't want to do anything. And like we are seeing that today. Like, you know, these morons gluing their hands to the fucking road, you know, throwing stuff on the paintings, like wanting to bring down the West, topple the statues, like bring everything down to a state of ugliness, right? Like that's what these, you know, these ugly, you know, forgive my word here, but like these turds, like I don't know what other way to like describe these people. Like this is what the last man is. And that's what Nietzsche sort of warned of. He said the world will get mired in this this kind of last man archetype. And you know, what he said though, also from there was from the last man will rise the Übermensch, which is the overman or the superman. And you know, this was his prediction. He said, like, basically, you know, it's another way of saying, you know, in the darkest point of the day, you know, the darkest point of the night, the dawn will come, right? Like it's darkest before the dawn or whatever. Is that the Übermensch is an archetype that is the complete opposite. In fact, you know, the way he frames the Übermensch is kind of like a the evolution of mankind. Like if you have the animals on one end, the Übermensch on the other, man is the tightrope that connects them, right? That's his in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, sort of how he frames it. And you know, the Übermensch is this archetype. Like you can think of it as a Alexander the Great meets Steve Jobs. You know, it's like maybe I'll explain it this way by way of an analogy. So remember in Fire Bitcoin Teleportation, I made a joke about Homo Bitcoinicus and Homo Hystericus, right? So like I said, you know, the world is going to bifurcate into these two sort of species of human, one being like Homo Hystericus, so the people that are on a subscription, you know, medical injection, wearing six masks, staying at home, eating
You don't
Netflix,
want to be cut
sorry,
out for this, then you move on.
watching Netflix, eating, you know, Cheetos or whatever. Like that's like one life versus the other one, which is the Bitcoin one. Like we're going out there, we're getting sunshine, we're, you know, eating steak, we're holding our wealth in Bitcoin, you know, we're building families, we're lifting, we're doing all these things. So I was like, imagine you take that out one, two, three, four generations, like you're gonna have two different species. And like that Homo Bitcoinicus species, that type, that archetype is where I think like you would go with the Übermensch, right? The Übermensch is a kind of, you know, superhuman that will emerge after multiple generations of good habits, good breeding, passing down capital. Like that's what happens. And that kind of person will rise most likely in a world where you're surrounded by lemmings, basically, by masses, by NPCs, by the last man. And that's like, you know, I went into the Übermensch, you know, you didn't ask about it, but I think it's just for people to understand the juxtaposition between the two. I think it's important.
Yeah, oh, I think that's fascinating. And then you went on to write that history has proved this again and again, with the modern world being the most evident example. We live in a world of excessive quantities and ever receding quality. Everywhere you turn, there's mass media, mass retail, mass politics, mass food, mass markets, mass social media, mass consumption, mass hysteria, mass medicine, mass money, mass everything. As a result, few of these things carry weight or value anymore. They contain no charge, they have no energy. They were like worthless Zimbabwean, hyperinflated toilet paper money. And from this kind of world, high quantities of low quality character people emerge. What do you think of dinks?
Yeah, that, I mean, what do you think? I think.
do you think there's a, well, I'll move through that. What, you know, I want to go back to will to power. And, you know, quality of money, and maybe why you think this is so important, and how it relates to Bitcoin.
Yeah, so I mean, so let's talk about quality and quantity then. So for me, These two are basically diametrically opposed. The more you increase the quantity of something, just fundamentally the lower its quality gets. Or the lower its perceived value is, right? So even if you can somehow maintain the physical structural integrity of it, thereby suggesting that it's got good quality, the fact that it is mass produced just changes the relationship one has to it. You know what I mean? Like it's like something becomes less cool. Like if everybody drove a Ferrari, like Ferrari wouldn't really be cool. You know what I mean? It'd be like a Toyota, right? So even though like if it had like if the Ferrari was still as perfect and beautiful and everything like that as it was like for the six that are out there, like if there's 6 million of them or 600 million of them, it's just not cool anymore. You know, like whatever. So there's this inverse relationship between quality and quantity, and we just see it everywhere. It's like, we kind of have turned our gaze as a civilization towards quantity, 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 quantity. And in the process, we've just created noise, right? There's very little signal, and it's just stuff out there everywhere, and nobody really gives a fuck anymore. And that's why we have no attention span. It's like, where do you look? You don't know where. And it's like you have to be extremely selective with your attention, so therefore you don't give it out to many places, and your attention span shortens and shortens for better or for worse, right? And you can apply, I mean, it just in the monetary space, it just applies there so well. And I think I say this in the essay. I say, look at fiat money. They have quantitative easing. They wanted to create a nice word for printing money, but in the word, in the etymology of the word, they are literally telling you what they're doing. They are easing the money by creating more quantity, right? So through a quantitative means, they are creating easier money. And what does that do to the quality of the money? It literally drops the quality of the money. Like, whereas Bitcoin is like completely 180 degrees different to that. It is quantitatively fixed, and as a result, its quality has an opportunity to increase. And I say it has an opportunity, it's not just going to magically increase. The opportunity for it to increase is if it can remain, or if it can keep its promise for its quantitative cap or its quantitative restriction, right? And its other promises as well, like the ability to send without being censored, et cetera, et cetera. So long as those things remain fixed and time passes and generations passes where that promise is able to be kept, kind of like what we said earlier about gold, people trust gold. You don't have to explain gold to somebody. It's just like we genetically know that gold is fucking gold, and like it's inert, it's not gonna react with anything, it's gonna last forever. Like you don't have to convince someone of that. Over time, you're not going to have to convince somebody that, hey, you can't create more Bitcoin, or no one can stop you from sending you Bitcoin, et cetera, right? As that happens and you have a fixed quantity, well, tell me what's the variable that's going to move? Well, the quality. And that is going to be reflected through the way people value it, which, as we as Bitcoiners know, that is why the price goes up. It's really simple, and I love that quality quantity sort of inverse relationship. Once that sort of like gets through people's heads, they it's indisputable what Bitcoin represents as a qualitative money.
Right. And we mentioned the Ubermensch, and I'm wondering, is this like a Superman, like one Steve Jobs, or, is this a single man that's going to rise up? And what needs to happen for, sort of the arrival of the Ubermensch?
Yeah, so we spoke about this earlier. So I think it's an archetype. It's not a single person. I don't know who the fuck the Ubermensch is. Some people have been like, oh, was Napoleon the Ubermensch? Or was like, and Nietzsche sort of said in many ways, like Napoleon was the precursor or an example of the kind of person who would represent the Ubermensch, right? I don't believe we've reached that stage. Like, I think what Nietzsche's talking about is a fundamentally evolved human being, and this is also another way where he was, prescient. He was like, he could see even before, the incredible technological progress we've had in the last 50 years. He could see that the age of man was potentially coming to an end, or at least the age of man in his current form, right? Like these days, we can do things that we just couldn't do before. So I don't believe we're near there yet. I think this is a process that'll take, many generations to breed fundamentally. And people are going to call me a eugenicist for that. And so what? Like, we breed horses, we breed animals. We as human beings need to take greater care with who we breed with. You know what I mean? Like, simple as that. You want the best wife possible, and your wife wants the best husband possible, so that you can produce the best kids possible, and you can pass down the best genes possible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that makes fundamental sense. And for me, the Übermensch, at least the way I understand it, is this archetype that emerges, as I said earlier, from intentional generational breeding, passing down of capital, passing down of knowledge, passing down of ideas, and you do that over a number of generations, you'll fundamentally have a different type of human being than you will from the people who are in the pods, eating the bugs and taking the injections, right? And that juxtaposition is going to show you an Übermensch versus a bug man. Like, and that's very interesting.
Yeah. And so then what do you think is Bitcoin's greatest contribution to humanity?
Yeah,
And I'll
so
frame it
this.
this way, is it to lift up the masses?
Well, why don't you read the do you have the paragraph in front of you? Because I think it's probably a good one to read.
Yeah. Most people think that Bitcoin's greatest contribution will be to lift the masses up and help the weak. While that will likely occur, not for the reasons you think. It will. It's my unpopular belief that the more important contribution and impact to mankind will be that Bitcoin makes the strongest stronger, the best better, and the most powerful more powerful. I can already feel you squirming as you read that line, so please read it again, then allow me to clarify why this is a good thing and of utmost importance. So
Yeah.
we'll read it once there,
Let's
but I'll let you
clarify.
clarify
Let's
because
clarify.
I was thinking I'm gonna get killed for asking this one.
Now look, this is a very important one, and I think it's probably the most important line in the essay, because I want to shake people awake. What I mean, and I chose my words very specifically. I didn't say make the strong stronger, or make the better man better. I said the best and the strongest, right? And the most powerful, more powerful. And what I mean by that is, if you put two people in a ring to fight, so let's use this as an example. Two people get in a ring, they fight. You would expect, notwithstanding luck, because sometimes luck shit happens, right? Somebody slips, somebody, misses a punch, accidentally gets knocked the fuck out, whatever, right? But by and large, generally speaking, the strongest person will win the fight, or the fastest, or the most skilled, or the most prepared, or the one with the most heart. Whatever your dimension of like best means, that's the person who's going to win the fight. And you want that to happen, because what you have then is a forcing function towards people being better in the fight, right? That's essentially what you want. And if you want any sort of civilization to operate towards people optimizing to be their best, well, you have to reward the best. You have to reward being the strongest. You don't go to the fucking Olympics so that you can be the weakest, right? You reward the strongest, right? You don't go to a race, you don't get in the NASCAR and get a medal for coming last. You get the medal for being the fastest, right? So all of these things, sports at least, are still functional largely. We haven't, eroded those to that degree. But like, you want to reward the best. And what my argument is that Bitcoin fundamentally makes for a world in which the best, or the most functional, the most competent, et cetera, they are the ones that get rewarded, right? So if you are fundamentally the best in your field, whatever that field is, the beauty of humanity, the beauty of a interconnected open economy, is that there is many dimensions to be the best in. You go and be the best, and you receive maximum reward. And that is the forcing function which drives humanity upwards. It creates an ascendance versus a descendance. And this, I believe, is far more important. If you just focus on the poor, the weak, the losers, this and that, you will optimize civilization for average. And average is the first step towards death. It is not nice to say, it doesn't feel warm and fuzzy and all that sort of shit, but it's the unfortunate truth. Like, average is a, it's, average is the philosophy of the last man. Average is it is a descendant energy. And this is something I learned from Tony Robbins a number of years ago. It's like, life has two options. Life is either growing or dying. That there is no in between. There's no like, oh, let's just, can't we get a bit of growth and a bit of death together? No, I'm sorry, bro. Like, you're growing or you're dying. It's one of the two. So you have to take a pick. And the growth part requires ascendant energy. The death part necessitates average energy. Average is a descendant energy. So, people who want to optimize for average, they're actually optimizing their culture and therefore their civilization for death. Like, they're in that direction. And it's not like you can kind of take the average path to excellence. No. You've like, you're on the wrong fucking path. You have to go the other way. And the other way, yes, by definition, it's going to leave some people behind. And particularly during a transition period where you've optimized for average and you've incentivized everybody for being average, then you switch towards excellence. Yeah, man, that's going to be, it's going to be an ugly transition. But unfortunately, it's got to happen. And it's better now. It's better to do it sooner than later when everybody is average, when everybody is like fat and ugly and depressed and lonely and all the things that are fucking happening to civilization. So, to sort of tie it back to the original framing, it's like, no, do not focus on, the weak, the poor, and all that sort of stuff. Like, they will get they, like the, this is the irony. You focus on the excellent and they raise everybody up. You focus on the weak and they bring everybody down. And so it's like, the latter just fucks everybody up, including the weak and the poor, whereas the former increases the wealth for everybody. So you just have to take your pick. And, I'm sorry, it's kind of like, it's one of those things. It's like, you may not like it, but that's the way it is. So, deal with it.
This is something, it's a point I want to stick on for a minute. So I remember I used to live in San Francisco 20 years ago. And I used to work out of there. I used to travel, but I used to go down to San Diego a lot. And you could see the stark difference just in policy and approach to a city, especially 20 years ago before California's state policy kind of overrode all this. But San Francisco and San Diego were going in very different directions, it seemed like, in very different microcosms. So you go on to write, first of all, I think we can agree on the following. You get more of that. You get more of that which is rewarded. If you reward theft, you will get more theft. Participation awards in school reward average students, not those who excel. ESG and DEI, or as Alex likes to call it, DIE, in the workplace results in hiring for politics instead of competence. And giving people money for staying home results in more people staying home, getting fat, lazy, and less productive. The converse is also true. When we reward people for doing a great job, they not only feel recognized, but feel a drive or will to do a great job once more. Therefore, my point is simple. If we want a strong society with competent people who are doing their best, then we must reward strength, competence, and those individuals who are the best in their chosen vocation. If we want society to grow, then its people must grow, so we must reward them for growing. If we want strong characters with high energy, it is these attributes we must reward. What is the formula? The formula is simple. Strong individuals equal strong society. Weak individuals equal weak society. So I want to turn to culture and politics a little bit. Is broken money at the root of these problems?
No, so this is something that I think we Bitcoiners have got wrong. We think that the root is the money. And I've come to believe now, particularly in my inquiry when I, as I've been writing the Bushido of Bitcoin, so this is kind of like a bit of a glimpse into that book, is I don't think the broken money is at the root. I think it's very early on, but it is a symptom of a deeper cancer, and I think that deeper cancer was something that Nietzsche touched on. Is this kind of introduction of equalitarianism, democracy, and kind of like an energy of average, right? Is that like you don't just, a civilization doesn't just wake up one day and be like, oh, you know what? Everything is fucking fantastic. Let's turn on the money printer. Like, it just doesn't happen like that. So the money printer turns on, or the idea to turn on a money printer comes once some level of decay has already set in, right? Some level of moral decay or virtuous decay or whatever, right? Like the strong men have largely already abdicated, and there is no one there to act as a as a check on that kind of stupidity, right? So does the money printing accelerate it? Fucking yes, like absolutely fundamentally yes. In fact, like maybe prior to the money printer, civilization could put the cancer into remission, right? By strong people getting up and leading again. But once the money printer kicks off and once that's established, then I think, the cancer starts to, accelerate in the body. And then at that point, it's too late to fix anything. The host has to die in order for, life to reemerge. And I think that's sort of what the money printer is. It's an accelerant. So at some point, like the money printer and the culture just feeds on itself, right? But I no longer, as a Bitcoiner, I no longer believe money is at the root of all the problems. There is a the root started earlier.
Right. And you go on to write, if you want a powerful meritocratic society, you must encourage powerful people and reward them for winning, i.e., for merit, not for cheating, lying, or stealing, not for quitting, not for just participating, but for achieving. This might sound harsh to some of you, and in some ways it is, but it's life. It's the hard pill to swallow that if you come to understand, thou shalt set you free because it's true, and that's precisely what the truth does. What is genuine strength, and why is it a virtue?
Yeah, this is a really, really important point. So, once again, people get triggered by some of the things I say, and then they're like, oh, but what if all the strong men just like go and like step on everybody? And I'm like, well, that's not the definition of a strong man, right? Like, so a strong person doesn't get into a ring and beat up a kid, right? Like that you've proven absolutely nothing, right? Like when Alexander went out to conquer Persia, it was because Persia was greater than what Macedonia was. He was punching up, not punching down, right? So like strong men go out and they either carry a greater burden or they pick a fight with something that stretches them, that pushes them. And this is so fundamentally important to understand. This is why modern central bankers and modern politicians are parasites. They're not strong people. They're not more powerful. They are the weak who have managed to come into power because otherwise strong men have abdicated their responsibility to have that power, right? So we've been taught that, oh, power is evil, power is evil, power is evil, power corrupts, power corrupts, power corrupts, all this fucking crap. So otherwise good men, otherwise strong men, otherwise responsible men have abdicated their duty to lead their families, their communities, their cities, their countries, their nations, their businesses, etc. And they've abdicated that to the greatest parasites in the world. Like when you abdicate from a position of power, you leave a vacuum for who? For the weak, for the pathetic, for those who want to win a fight by tying their opponent's hands behind their backs. That is not strong. That is the weak person winning. This is what people have to get through their fucking heads when they start to like get triggered by, what I've written here. It's like, no, the definition of strong is like it's intimately entwined with responsible. A responsible person is someone who bears the weight of decision, of the responsibility. The more you can bear, the stronger you are. That is the definition of strength, right? And this is why I say that powerful people, like, or sorry, the strong must be the ones who wield power, not the weak. And that's what you want because the strong man is able to lift, to rise, to encourage, to ascend. The weak with power just want to trample all over other people because they are projecting their weakness on everybody else. That is a very, very different. It's like such a, it's a, once you unlock that in your brain, like once that paradigm shift sort of kicks in, you completely see the world differently. You start to understand that leadership is fundamentally important. Like one of my pet hates in Bitcoin is that, just because Bitcoin itself as a network is leaderless, doesn't mean that, Bitcoin as a movement is leaderless. Like Bitcoin as a movement is fundamentally leaderful. Like there is different leaders in different dimensions in Bitcoin. Like there was a tweet from Bitcoin Sapiens, I think the other week where he was saying, if these 10 people agree to make a Bitcoin change, then I'll agree. And it was like Excellion, Luke Dash Jr., blah, 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 right? And people like sort of gave him, sure, Bitcoin has no leaders, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, that's total fucking bullshit. Nobody, like, I don't understand the BIPs, So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look to someone who has developed the reputation, for a position on Bitcoin, and I'm going to, trust that person because, he is a leader in understanding some element about Bitcoin that I don't, because I can't fundamentally understand everything. So it's like this, it drives me nuts, but leaders are fundamentally important in a civilization, in a culture, and in Bitcoin too, But Bitcoin as a protocol is leaderless, but that is different to Bitcoin, the movement, Bitcoin, the socioeconomic thing. And this, to sort of tie it back into what we're saying about strength, a strong person is a responsible person, is a leader. It ties into my Millet tweet from the other day that triggered a bunch of people. It's like, Millet is a different beast because he is fundamentally, someone who represents leadership, strength, and energy. And he's also got policy and sense to back it up. Like so he's a very, very interesting sort of archetype. But anyway,
Well,
it's such an important point.
I want to get into Malay, so we're going to get to there hopefully quickly. So, I like how you kind of bring up that, responsible men are the strongest. One question I had throughout reading this, and I wonder, are strong men and women, whatever it is, choosing to be parasites right now because they understand the playing field and they don't want to live weakly. Which in some ways might be living stronger by, swimming, upstream or fighting back or not doing that stuff, but maybe not gaining, the gravitas of society because the rewards are going to parasites. And I wonder if some people are being persuaded by that, or if, there are so few weak, so few strong people that it is the weak that are becoming parasites, and the strong are opting out in some way or finding some other way to get where they got to go. And I would love to, get into another time, maybe around territory and frame. But around this, so just thinking about this, you bring up three words that are very loaded in today's society: elite, aristocrat, and noble. So maybe, we could talk a little bit about where those words come from, or why we might want to think about them differently now.
So the what was your first point again that you just sort of mentioned
So
before
I
frame
was
and
talking about
stuff?
whether, some strong people are choosing to act in a, parasitic manner because they can recognize that, they're not going to be rewarded for being, quote unquote, going the other direction and appearing weak or going with that crowd. And they're like, hey, I could go this way and, squash a bunch of NPCs along the way anyway, and be a part of the winning team.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think Andrew Tate's a great example of that. He's, he just doesn't like, and honestly, like sometimes I question myself, like, I'm like, fuck, why have I been so stupid? Like, I could have, shitcoined, I could have done all this sort of stuff, made way more money. And to a degree, he's a perfect example. He's like, and I can't fault him, honestly. Like, because the game is set up that way. Fuck it. Like, these people are fucking scumbags. At least he's like, he's not doing a Klaus Schwab, right? Like, or he's not doing a Christine Lagarde. Like those people are like fundamentally parasitic, right? So, you could even throw Elon Musk in that sort of camp, right? Like, people have a problem with, him doing like the electric cars and all that fucking dog shit, right? And his Dogecoin stuff like that. But, fundamentally, he's taking advantage of the system, to further his interests and what he believes is the right way to channel humanity's resources and stuff like that. So once again, I can't fault him for that. Peter Thiel, he's another example of that. So I think, yes, because the playing field, because the board game that we're on is fundamentally inclined towards, incentives that are, that produce ugly results, you're going to get people who otherwise like would have really, really excelled. Like I think Andrew Tate, for example, on a Bitcoin standard would be an extremely powerful individual. But the opportunity was there and he took it and he's winning at that. And like I said, good on him. I can't fault him for being the best in his field for what he's doing. He fucking killed it. Is there degrees? Yes. And this is where we sort of get into moralizing and stuff like that, which, sometimes can get a little bit like, browbeating. It's like, I'm more moral than you because I don't do this, X, Y, and Z. Fucking congratulations, bro. Like if you're a loser and, your claim to fame is, you're more moral because of what you said on Twitter, like nobody cares. Like, Andrew Tate probably, despite some of his like, weirder, like despite some of the things, we might disagree on with respect to how he makes money, like he's done a lot of good as well. Like really, really, really a lot of good. With the, with the charity work that he does, with the, with just the a lot of the truth bombs that he drops, and the stuff like the ideas that he's putting into people's heads, etc. Like, his counter narrative, like that stuff is all fundamentally important, and he's doing more than many of us to get, a counter opinion out there. So, it's very easy to point at people and moralize and, play holier than thou, but, when the system is structured in such a way, like sometimes, you have to work with it to make the most of it, right?
Yeah.
And that's where I think that fits in. So anyway, that was that. Then you said the words like elite,
Elite.
aristocrat, noble. Yeah. So
Yep.
I mean, etymologically, like elite is associated to excellence. Excellence fundamentally means like the separation of oneself from average, like to excel, to ex like the Proto-Indo-European roots of the word mean like land and mountain, like to climb a mountain, to ascend, to separate oneself from the mass, right? That's fucking fantastic. We want more excellent people. So, elite means like to be excellent, to separate oneself, to be the cream of the crop. So why have we given the word elite to the scumbags and the parasites? So, we fundamentally need to take that back. Aristocrat, Aristos and Kratia, like best and power. So, aristocracy means the rule of the best and most powerful. That's what it fundamentally means. There's nothing wrong with that. That's exactly what we want. We do not want rule of the weak, because rule by the weak and of the weak creates communism. That's literally what the Bolsheviks were. The Bolsheviks went out and they killed the royal families because the royal families had claim, had lineage, had real strength. So they just killed them and then they fucking destroyed Russia. And they destroyed Europe. And finally, noble. Nobility, I don't have the etymology in front of me, but like it means to be best, to be honorable, to be truthful, to be pure, to be to be excellent, to have some sort of lineage. Like these things matter. And once again, we scoff at these things, which is so fucking pathetic in my mind. Like these are the things we must strive for. And we've been conned and convinced in modern civilization to laugh at these things. And the joke's on us in the end, because we're the ones behaving more like peasants and like plebs. Like we literally, Bitcoiners call themselves plebs. Fuck is wrong with you? Like why do you want to be a lower class of being? Like what's aspiring about that? What is ascendant about that? Nothing. Nothing. You're literally calling yourself a peasant. Congratulations. You're an idiot.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think I kind of revolted a little bit too at, why are we calling ourselves plebs? I kind of took it from the forefront of like Bitcoin is humbling, and I get it. I'm humbled, and I'm one of the many who are trying to understand this. But at the same time, I'm like, why? I'm not trying to say that I'm better than everyone else, but like, why would I want to be like everyone else or identify or label myself as anything? I get what you're saying there. I want to turn to beauty. And because the piece really brought up interesting thoughts for me here. And what maybe is the opposite of beauty for you?
Yeah, communism. So this is something I've been on a rant recently. Is like, beauty is the highest ideal, right? Beauty is God. Beauty is perfection. Beauty is that which fits. You don't know why something is beautiful, but it's fucking beautiful. Like, we look at these sunsets and a sunrise. Beautiful mountains. A beautiful woman. Like, there's things that are just like, or a lion running. Through, like it's a beautiful thing to see. And it's like we don't have to, like. a dork might say, well, all things are, beauty is subjective. It's in the eye of the beholder. It's like, no, shut the fuck up. Like, beauty is strangely objective and subjective, right? It's like, and it's one of the only things that, possesses that quality. Like everything else, everything that's material can be subjectively valued, but beauty is something that's metaphysically, objectively valuable and materially, subjectively valuable. And you mix those two together, you get something very, very interesting. And, like Nietzsche argues that, beauty is the most expensive thing because it takes generations to produce, right? So like, you have these beautiful cathedrals all throughout Europe that took hundreds of years to build, right? And like that kind of beauty is only possible with the maximum sacrifice, which is multiple generations of lives to go into the building and the construction of said cathedral, and people who started it would never get to fucking see it. And that is incredible. Like, that's what it takes to build beauty. And, what it takes to have communism is just to tear it all down. Like, communism is the ultimate high time preference. Beauty is the ultimate low time preference. And for me, these things are fundamentally diametrically opposed. And yeah, I've really come to appreciate beauty. And I got a lot of hate for this, like literally a year ago, in Europe, when I was, doing some, really edgy tweets, about beauty, and, people sort of yelling, kicking, screaming, and bitching about like my opinion. But, I've doubled down on it. I fundamentally think I was right then. Maybe my delivery wasn't great, but like, I was right then, I'm right now. Beauty is the ultimate.
It's interesting. I think I remember that. What's really interesting to me here, though, and I think, because a lot of people maybe resent, the desire for beauty, or and we're going through a weird thing with advertising commercials where there's less aspirational beauty. But reading this piece and just thinking a lot about beauty, I think that beauty comes from within, like external beauty. So for a society to reveal beauty or to be beautiful, it has to be beautiful within. It has to create values, morals, virtue. Same thing for an individual. A lot of people I think that maybe the most beautiful people are the worst people sometimes. And I've come to find a lot of people, the most beautiful people are beautiful on the inside. And I think that maybe there's a crowd of people that hang around the beautiful people that are not so beautiful on the inside that maybe get conflated through popularity, and what, beauty does. So I thought that was really powerful. I want to round this out with just getting into Malay then. There's so much more to talk
Cool.
about, but what do you make of Malay? I was very surprised by the thread you put out or the long form tweet that you just had such an informed opinion, not that you had an informed opinion about it, but that you had deep thoughts on it and such strong conviction and an interesting take. So I'll just leave it at there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been watching the Malay thing for a little while now, and as many of us skeptical in the beginning. But then when I started like, hearing some of the videos and, my wife is Spanish, so I just get her to validate everything. Like, I mean, I speak enough Spanish, but I get her to like validate everything. She's like, yep, that's what he's saying. And I'm like, man, this guy's fucking based. And particularly like, he's you can see people's energy, right? And like, the way he speaks about like leftism in particular, because I think leftism is, it is fundamentally a cancer, because leftism is where equalitarianism, these democratic ideals, the average, all this sort of shit, that's where it stems from, right? This is what Nietzsche was warning us about. And if you want to know like where the root of all this stupidity is, like, communism has its root as well in the French Revolution with Jacobins. Like, so it sort of all flows back there to this kind of ideal of the left, right? So it is a fundamental cancer. So, watching him articulate these things, watching him, articulate his position, on economics and stuff like that, and, how to restructure the state and everything, man, I just found refreshing and inspiring. And, yeah, like I was having a conversation with Mark Moss, actually. Sorry, yeah, so I was on his podcast last week, and he asked me about Millet. He's like, oh, well, do you think that this disproves your position against democracies, like, because the people voted him in? And I said, actually, no. I said, people voted him in not because they understood his policies. People don't fucking understand any of the policies. They can't read it. They're economically illiterate. They're politically illiterate. They don't fucking get it. What they voted in was somebody who represented a different energy. And that's what that charge is what captured people. And that's got nothing to do with policy. It's got nothing to do with libertarianism. That's got nothing to do with oh, he's doing the right things, all this sort of stuff. People have no fucking idea. But he came in there with conviction, with an energy, with a charge. And that magnetism is what drew people toward him. And he did a fantastic campaign. Like, he did a fucking fantastic campaign. And he is memorable, man. Like, he's the guy with the crazy hair, calling, the leftist parasites, talking to his dead dog, all this sort of stuff. Like, he developed a meme about himself. So he fucking killed it. Like, he absolutely fucking killed it. And to me, like Trump in that sense, people, fundamentally, Trump's policies, were probably, I mean, not probably, they are far shittier than Milei's. Like, a lot of his policies are fucking garbage, but he represented a different energy, and that's what attracted people. And that doesn't, that's not a defense for democracy. That's a defense for the strong man, right? Like, the strong leader. The strong leader is the one that will rally people when the time comes. And that's what someone like Milei, that's what someone like Trump represented. Except, the beauty of Milei is that he's actually got sensible policies to back up his energy that he sort of comes with. That's why I said he's the mix of Ron Paul and Trump.
Well, it's really fascinating. I want to get into this a bit, run through it. So you wrote why Milei won and is winning, and you wrote to win, what matters is energy, magnetism, and leadership. To keep winning, you need policy and execution, plus a little time and grace. The way you phrase this, it kind of reminded me of JFK versus Nixon the first time with TV and people capturing JFK's energy and magnetism, and that appeal. And it wasn't really about policy and what you're getting into. I don't know what to make of world politics sometimes because I'm thousands of miles away from all this. I know it's coming through so many different lenses of narratives and propaganda and anecdotal and data driven. And I saw pictures of him with Bill Clinton, and he's obviously trying to leave or get rid of the local currency, but maybe move to the dollar, which to me is just another central backed central bank. So. But I saw the energy, I saw the magnetism, I saw what you get at with the authentic authority. So it's fascinating. Like, I think people will build on the sort of the Trump recipe, but it seems like a really pretty easy blueprint. Like, show some energy, so show some passion, believe in what you're saying, and maybe offer an alternative. You put together a really interesting chart where you charted out energy and charisma and policies, dysfunctional versus and functional versus weak and strong, and where everyone laid out, and you kind of put Ron Paul as sort of maybe the godfather or grandfather of this movement, which I thought was interesting. And what I also thought really interesting, what you wrote about Argentina, was Argentina's place in the world, having gone through many cycles of being the wealthiest nation, and it's a resource rich nation, and he's got a really fantastic opportunity to maybe do what El Salvador has done, but maybe on a grander scale.
Way grander scale.
So then I'd love to ask you maybe about what do you think of Barack Obama's leadership style?
I mean, he was charismatic. He was a great speaker. He was he definitely wooed the people, right? Like, people loved him for his capacity to get on stage and string together not only a coherent sentence but an inspiring sounding sentence, right? He made the dumbest ideas sound cool, right? Because of the way he was able to deliver them. He was great at that. Policy was about as bad as you can fucking get, right? Like, he was an absolute disaster. He's an example of what you get when you mix great delivery of ideas, and great charisma with fucking ineptitude. Look what happened to America during his time.
I like what you noted about Trump in this piece. Likewise with Trump, he came out of nowhere. He was different. He did what nobody else ever had, and he fundamentally changed the game. His energy inspired a new movement. And now the best way to define who's who in each country's politics is whether they are like or unlike Trump. Germany's Trump, Holland's Trump, Poland's Trump, Australia's Trump. You do kind of see that where he's kind of built that mold. I still believe in the uniparty. And I think that whether he's a heel and he knows about it or doesn't know, or, you know, or just give him the right incentive, I don't understand. But what I do want to ask is, what do you think of Putin then?
He's an anomaly. I mean, I think he's he's got the energy, and he seems to have a Russia-centric policy that's working for Russia. I fundamentally think he's good for Russia. I don't know the details because I'm not sort of versed on that, but my instinct is that he's a net positive for Russia. That's about as knowledgeable as I am there.
Right. And then Jeffrey A. Tucker on my show, he mentioned with Milei, maybe it's possible that, you know, like they've managed to capture anarcho-capitalism as a movement. And this is their way of, you know, sort of the way they used Che Guevara and changed what he represented and made it a movement, put him on T-shirts or whatever, capturing the vibe. And maybe it's controlled or opposition. Who knows? So to round this out then, how do you think the price of Bitcoin fits into all of this? You know, laying the soil for the Ubermensch, creating strong men, or giving maybe better opportunities to strong men and women. How do you think the price of Bitcoin fits all into all that?
Price, interesting. I mean, kind of like, you know, I said earlier that as Bitcoin, you know, maintains this fixed quantity, like it, you know, represents this thing that we over time can trust more and more and more and more and more. Bitcoin's fundamental quality will increase. You know, you've got a qualitative hardening. And, you know, as the quality increases and the quantity remains fixed, the perceived value will continue to increase. And therefore, so will demand. But because you can't increase the supply, then there's only one way for the price to go. So I mean, it's just like for
but
me.
Do you think it makes
like,
us? Do you think it's going to make the people we want stronger? I mean, do we need price to go up to give people morals and virtues and value the right values, the strength?
No.
Is that part of the soil?
Okay, so
is that feeding
okay.
the
no, I see what
not
you're saying.
The beast in a bad way, but in a good way?
Yeah.
I'm not asking for a price prediction.
Okay, now I understand. Okay, so yes. Fundamentally speaking, this is entirely what my Bushido Bitcoin book is about. I say, okay, like once we're all fucking rich, we have a choice to become one of three things: the next politically parasitic class, right? Because that may happen, and some of us may choose that path. We could become the fucking Richard Hart, Louis Vuitton wearing, you know, Lamborghini driving morons that just like flaunt our wealth, you know, or we could be men and women of virtue. And, you know, it's not just a given that we become the last one. In fact, it's probably more likely that we become one of the first two. So therefore, it's incumbent on us from today to begin inculcating and developing these virtues, lest we end up in a situation where we become fucking the same turds that we are fighting against today, right? So this is fundamentally important for us to do. And it's going to be important, like if we want to preserve our lineage. You know, you don't want to end up with a son or a grandson that just becomes a cocaine addict, you know,
right,
having, you know, sex with virtual porn stars, right? Like in the future VR world. Like, because that, like, imagine you spent all this time like stacking sats and saving and everything. It's like two generations later, it all gets burnt because
they should be real life porn stars.
Like, yeah, whatever. But this is so important. Like this is where I guess Bitcoin will be, you know, very interesting, is that those who can manage to inculcate the right values and the right virtues, those who can operate by a playbook that can preserve capital and that can preserve virtue down the generations, they're the ones who are going to become, I believe, the future kings and queens. They're the ones who are going to preserve their capital. The rest of them are going to squander it. Simple as that. And, you know, if you want to prepare yourself for that, like, I honestly think what I've written with the Bushido Bitcoin is going to be the most important thing written in the entire Bitcoin space, bar none. Like, and I'm not saying that to blow smoke up my own ass, but I really lean into this question. It's like, what are the virtues and the principles that we need to develop if we are going to inherit the earth? Like, that's the most important thing we need to think about right now. Like, more than anything else, more than fucking inscriptions, this and that, all the other bitching and arguing that we've got going on. Like, more importantly, is who are we going to become? And what is going to be a code of virtue that transcends, religion and race and all this other crap? Because, it's impossible to create one global religion or one global race or one global thing. Like the whole point is we want loose alliances and multiple cultures, but we want to have some principles that we can align across. And if we have those, if we have some virtues, like, for example, courage. Courage is something that cross-culturally is valued. And you can nod at someone when you know they've done something courageous, right? That's a virtue. It's not a moral belief. Completely different. Moral beliefs we can disagree on, but virtues we can't because virtues are acts. So this is where I think we need to focus on. I can't think of something more important to discuss and start having conversations about. And it's precisely what I wrote Bushido for. And I mean, when that book comes out next year, we'll have a discussion about that. But like, it's the price of Bitcoin will matter. In so like it's gonna magnify who we are. That is so freaking important.
I agree, and I can't wait to read the book when it comes out. And I, touching on what we said earlier, habits, our habits will become our grandchildren's instincts, and that's why what you're
Instincts,
getting at is so
for
important.
sure.
So my final question to you, and you're the only person I've ever asked this twice, and I'll probably continue this tradition with you because I'd love to hear your take on this. Do you want to see an accelerated launch to hyper-Bitcoinization or a slow grind?
I can't even remember what I said last time.
Doesn't matter. That's what's great about it.
Okay, the 2023 end of 2023, Alex, honestly is now preferring something a bit quicker. Yeah, I think something faster, because maybe this is the selfish part of me, is like I would like to, I mean, I haven't said this on any other podcast, but my 10-year plan is to go and take over Macedonia. Milei has inspired me to a massive degree, and I think I can go in there. I have Macedonian lineage, and I think I can go in and actually fundamentally transform that territory into what I envision as a country as a service. Like the whole thing would operate on an app. You would have a membership, instead of citizenship and residency, or just have membership tiers, and you pay country as a service for like living in the greatest place. And for that dream to become a reality, I would like Bitcoin to be valued quite high, because that'll make my ability to do that much easier. So, speaking selfishly, I would like to see this happen quicker.
I'm never gambling any sats or giving any of them away, but I would venture to say on the last show a year ago, you said slower. And I think it's just such an, it's almost out, it's just for the sake of altruistic to say slower. I mean, we'd be no other way incentivized to get to that stronger, better, more moral, virtuous place, or even just better place for us if it was faster. But I get how there's the consequences, and consequences mean good or bad, just on how that plays out. But Alex, this has been so dope as always. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I wish you the best of luck with the release. Please let everyone know where they can find you and your work, and then go get that knee better.
Amazing. Brother, thank you again. Really enjoy our conversations. People, if they want to check out the essay, just go to svetsky.info. That'll take you to my link tree. The top link is actually my the Nietzsche article, if people want to have a read of that. And then obviously follow me on Twitter and you'll hear about Bushido and all of the crazy things I'm doing next year.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been dope.
Thank you, brother. Thank you.
Peace. Hey, that's a wrap on today's episode of the Bitcoin Matrix Podcast with Alex Svetsky. I hope that you found it as informative and enlightening as I did. Hit us up. We'd love to hear your feedback. I want to thank you for tuning in. Please keep in mind, I only work with the best Bitcoin-focused sponsors, and they are a big reason I can deliver this content to you for free. So I hope that you check them out and support them. Finally, if you could write a 5-star review for the Bitcoin Matrix podcast wherever you listen to your pods, that would really help get the word out and help new listeners find the show. Keep building, keep stacking, always stay laser focused out there, and let's keep working a free Ross. This is Cedric. Peace.